So this is a very strange week. We are floating in a space in our little culture here between Martin Luther King Day yesterday, the last week of the presidency of our first and can I just say excellent. Our first African-American president and one of the most excellent of my lifetime, maybe the most excellent in my sense. Jimmy was pretty good, too. I wrote to Jimmy Carter when I was 6, and he sent me back a signed photo of the first family.
Aww.
I know. As an adult, I probably would have written to whoever was president, but as an adult, I'm really proud that it was him and not 2 years later. And on Friday, there is a serious change of administration happening and portending all sorts for this country. So I want to talk a little bit tonight about white supremacy. And I'm going to frame it in relation to the Buddhist teaching of karma. So first, a little bit about karma. Karma is a Sanskrit word. The Pali version used in early Buddhism is kamma. And it literally means action. So its earliest usage, its earliest, in a sense, non-doctrinal usage, was probably as a grammatical term. If you study Sanskrit, you learn that the doer of action in a sentence, what we would call the subject sometimes, but not exactly, is the karman, and the thing that receives the action is the kartar. So, like, if I drop the phone, the one who does the dropping, is the karman, and the thing that is dropped is the kartar, the recipient of the action. And what this does, and right now, especially now that I'm recording, because I've been doing that lately, I'm like, wait, did I get that backwards? So if I did, I apologize to Sanskrit. It's the same root. The root is kr, K-R. And there's a clear definition of action, in a way, in its grammatical usage, which is that something does something to something, or something does something and there's a result. And the earliest usage of the word in yoga meaning the proto-Hindu, Hindu and Buddhist yoga streams, practice streams, it evolved into, in its sort of early incarnation, a teaching on what the results of actions were. And this was central to early Indian philosophy. And by early, I'm meaning around what's called the Axial Age. The Buddha's period was about 500 BCE, before the Common Era. So starting a few hundred years before that and going for quite some time after is a whole period of philosophical speculation in which the role or the behavior of actions is one of the central concerns. So one group of folks says, actions have no particular effects, good or ill. It doesn't matter what you do, right? Like, there's no punishment for bad action. There's no reward for good action. Actions are empty. That was one philosophical idea that came out. Another one, came out that actions matter, but only in this way. Someone else said actions matter in this way. And there was a whole debate going on essentially around how we function as individuals and cultures, how we create things, how we act in relationship to each other. All of this built on the earliest ideas of action, which were the religious action of the fire sacrifice. The priests, the Brahmins, would get donations from the wealthy, the Kshatriya caste, and use those donations to make expensive sacrifices of animals or foods, precious substances. And the smoke from that sacrifice would rise up to the heavens and feed the gods. So in a certain way, the gods were the recipient of action. And the humans in various ways were the initiators of action. And then there's the action of burning itself. So the Buddha came along and he offered something different. He offered a very particular interpretation into this stream. He strongly sided on the side of those who said that actions matter, first of all, that they do have effects, and that those effects are good and bad, or the bright and dark is the term used in the texts. He went further than that, however, and proposed that actions have effects that are both inevitable and also nonlinear. In other words, every action absolutely will have an effect, but it's impossible to actually know exactly precisely what that's going to be. And particularly, it's very difficult to backtrack and say, given this result, like what's happening now, can we trace that to this exact action in the past in a sort of one-to-one correspondence? And the Buddha said, no, that's not possible. It's too complex. And his core theory was one of conditionality. This is going to get abstract for a moment, but I'm going to come back to white supremacy very soon. Conditionality essentially says that what's happening is based on what happened before in an unpredictable way, such that a given set of circumstances conditions the experiences that follow it, but doesn't in a certain way predict them. In other words, our gathering tonight conditions some things, right? It conditions perhaps all of us to think about karma and white supremacy. Maybe it conditions some inspiration for practice. Maybe it conditions, you know, disagreement and revulsion. But exactly what it conditions for each one of us is unknown, because it's not the only thing doing the conditioning, right? You also carry, right here in the room, your entire life history and your family's life history and your communities and your cultures. So if you are a given race, class, gender, ethnicity, religion, orientation, etc., that those conditions condition how you even receive this, right? All of this comes out to be essentially an infinitely complex web of relationship. We're in relationship to everything that's happened in the past, and we, in every moment, do things that create the conditions for the next moment, for ourselves and others. So karma simply, or somewhat simply as a teaching, says this: all of our actions have results, and those results are either wholesome or unwholesome, essentially. They cause harm or they cause well-being, and often a mixture, right? And one more thing that the Buddha was unique about is he said that the thing that determines whether the result is wholesome or unwholesome is intention. In other words, where did the action come from? And the example given, one of many examples given in the text that I've spoken in here before, is the example of cutting someone with a knife. And that if you're angry at someone and you cut them with a knife with the intent to harm them, that's a very different action than a surgeon cutting someone with a knife with the intent to heal them. same action, perhaps. It could even cause the same pain in a certain way. It hurts to be cut, no matter what the intention. But the karma is different, right? Because the action is different, because the intention is different. Intention helps to give rise to what the result is. And it's also not the only condition, like everything, right? A surgeon can have good intentions, but him or herself be colored by, for instance, bad information and cause harm, or colored by their own conditioning and cause harm. So intention, our intention in each action, weaves together with all the conditions that are already present to give rise to the result. So, karma is one way of talking about how vectors of activity or energy or intent move through the world, move through time, really. So, in this week, as we hover between these very potent markers of culture, we find appearing in our American culture right now, and growing over the past several years, more and more, in a sense, public visibility of this force called white supremacy that has been active in the world for centuries, many, but is flowering right now in a very particular way and expressing itself in a very particular way in the current election and transfer of power. What is white supremacy? White supremacy, maybe simply we can say, is a doctrine or a belief system or an ideology. Ideology coming from idea, an idea that has taken root as a cultural force and guides belief, a belief system. It's an ideology that folks with a certain skin tone are superior in some way to folks of other skin tones. Very specifically, it at the moment is isolating those with European and Northern European heritage as supreme, to use the same word, as supremacy. And of course, each word in it is problematic, right? The word white is problematic. White is not a ethnicity, it's not a race. And it's a very ambiguous color, actually, right? There's all sorts of people who look white but have non-white backgrounds. There's folks who look not white, who have Northern European backgrounds. It's a difficult term to define, which is partly why it's subtle and sticky and powerful. Slavery in the United States has been called the United States' original sin, like the founding sin of this country. And now I'll use the word sin kind of in Christian quotation marks, but they're relevant given the Christian centric nature of this nation. White supremacy, if we think about it in karmic terms, we can say is a force that moves through generations, that affects everything it comes into contact with, and and appears its results in the world largely unwholesome, right? Many of the results that we can see that we can connect to this force of culture appear unwholesome, right? The ongoing really unspeakable oppression of persons of color in this country, both in overt ways, in that we see in police brutality and overt, you know, racism and hostility, but almost more harmful, the subtle, not subtle, inequities built into everything, built into policy, built into housing and neighborhoods and economics and jobs and everything contains, is tainted by, colored by this. The definition of unwholesome is causes harm. So in a certain basic way, we can say, like, we can see harm being caused. And so then where does this come from? I think back to the colonial period as I learned about it, and European nations, particularly Britain, France, Portugal, Spain, a little bit Italy, sending armies out to colonize, to occupy, to extract resources from, to trade with, to learn from other cultures. When the Brexit vote happened, I wrote in my notebook, Brexit is the karmic result of colonialism. And I had thought about, you know, the British, like, I thought about the sun not setting on the British Empire. And so I thought about the British in India and South Africa and, you know, through Indonesia and through Southeast Asia and in Burma and of course in North America, and then about the specific relationships of, like, you know, these British officers and these Indian princes and laborers and workers and then the way that it all mixed, and that some Brits would marry Indians and some Indians would marry Brits and the Burmese and then, you know, wealthy Indians start studying at Oxford and Cambridge and then going home and becoming powerful, or staying in England and becoming powerful. And then hardly a couple centuries later, and you have a working class British public saying, wait, I don't want the results of that. I don't want to not to be, become minority in my country. I don't want brown folks. I don't want more Indian folks here. And to think, like, This is the result of that, you know. This is the result of that contact. Contact is action, right? What an action is to make contact with something. If we go to intention, the definition of unwholesome intention is intention guided by what's called the three fires, or the three poisons, or the three roots of suffering, which are greed, hatred, and delusion. So I think about colonialism, and I think about some people with some power that, again, came not through their own superiority, but through some forces that were, you know, that kind of gathered together. Why do some cultures become powerful and others don't? The thesis in Jared Diamond's book, Guns, Germs, and Steel, is essentially that it's kind of random. And it's a randomness specific to geography. Cultures that were surrounded by other cultures that had lots of relationships and communication weren't very isolated, weren't very secure, got stronger through relationship, through trading, through travel. And then there's some quirks of history. Why this disease spread in this way across this vector, why this natural resource was available here and not there. One beautiful, strange detail that I remember hearing was that that England should be pretty Arctic. It's very, very far north. And the reason that it's so temperate and green and having the conditions then for a very thriving, diverse culture is partly that there is this kind of freak of the Atlantic jet stream that warms it in this very particular way. That jet stream just changed, like last year. So some arc of like, it's not even just colonialism, like, oh, a few bad Europeans got greedy for resources and wrecked the world. It's deeper than that. It's like, oh, how did they get that powerful to begin with? You know, I don't know. There were some people that happened to be on this island that was warm. Right? And the long result of that through the Industrial Revolution that the Brits helped start and the coal plants and then the changing climate and then the jet stream crosses the equator for the first time south. It's all connected. So we can trace white supremacy back to maybe like this primal feeling that there's our group and there's other. We can trace it to the roots of how power concentrated in the hands of these few nations. We can trace it to the delusion that if I have been given power and privilege, we could say, that means that I'm superior. Like I stumbled into having a culture that has some things, guns, literature, whatever. I meet up with another culture that has different things. I'm able to defeat them. And it's a delusion, right? It was greed that took me there. I want their stuff, perhaps, or I want experiences or more. And hatred that saw them as other, or fear, hatred and fear, siblings. And then it's delusion to say, oh, because I have power, I must be better. And so then this kind of justification arising. All of this is a way of saying that the belief in what that we call white supremacy is owned by no one. It's not a personal failing or a sin, as much as it is a foul wind that blows through time. And at this point, colors everything on the globe. It's one of the forces of delusion that really got traction. It hasn't always been there, but it's old. And it's not just the Europeans that have it. Part of what the Buddha resisted in his time, 500 BCE, was the early caste system. And the early caste system in India was called Jati, which means birth, meaning whatever you're born into, that's what you are, and it doesn't change. It was also called Varna, which means color. So the upper castes, classes, Brahmin and Kshatriya classes, were lighter skinned. And the lower classes and castes, the workers, the Vaishya, the merchant class, and the Shudra, the laborer castes, were darker skinned. And the preference for light skin over dark persists in India now. You can buy this, the counters are of the pharmacies are full of skin whitening cream. The way we would have skin softening cream, they have skin whitening cream. The Buddha was the most prominent of the early schools of ascetic practice to say that when you come into the community, you lose your caste. You lose your color, as it were. And that resistance that he institutionalized in the monastic sangha, in the Buddhist sangha, persisted through to the 20th century, such that in the 1950s, a powerful politician from the untouchable caste named Ambedkar publicly converted to Buddhism with tens of thousands of followers, in resistance to Hinduism and the caste system. As soon as they, and this is a legal maneuver, as soon as they converted, they were eligible for all of these benefits in the society that they were denied because of their caste. But the Indian constitution recognizes that if you're not Hindu, you don't belong to the caste system, so you're outside of that system of benefits. And they shifted their identity immediately by doing so. So what do we do about this? Core central to the Buddhist contemplative work, or the personal or individual path of Buddhism, is a kind of inquiry of ourselves and our own patterns. Really, it says, look at yourself, look at your actions, and really see if you can discern what your intentions are, right? Begin to move your intentions from those motivated by greed, hatred, and delusion to those motivated by their opposites, essentially kindness, generosity, and wisdom. And to do that, we have to begin to unpack our own conditioning. It's imperative to remember as we do this, and this is unique in a certain way to Buddhism, different from other aspects of, say, activist work, even of kind of white awakening work and other work that's out there for racial consciousness. The Buddhist orientation toward this work is always to remember that these things that we're unpacking are not, we don't own. That our conditions are vast, and they're vaster than our individual selves. That to the extent that I benefit from white supremacy, I want to know that and see it. I want to know it as a privilege, unearned. The definition of privilege is a benefit that I carry that I didn't earn myself. And I want to see, both. I want to see its unwholesomeness, meaning I need to look more carefully at the results of the system that gave me that privilege and see its results. So I need to know more about what's happening for those who are oppressed by it. And then I need to look at my own actions and more deeply my own belief systems, especially the subtle kind of unconscious assumptions that I carry. It is by definition difficult to look at things that are unconscious. So that is true. Therefore, therapy, analysis, process groups, you know, focus groups, what do they call them in this? Encounter groups, right? Encounter people. Consciousness raising, right? You got to do it. You have to actually bring things into consciousness from unconsciousness, subconsciousness. And this is painful. Perhaps. It's also kind of marvelous and liberating. One of the things that's hardest right now, I think, in doing this work is the transition from thinking that everything's okay, like not going very well, but basically okay, to recognizing that things are not going well because they are fundamentally not really okay. And I'm going to leave out for now the sort of the overarching teaching, you know, of like cosmic dharma, that they are fundamentally okay. But but particularly to wake up to the patterns, the conditions, the karmic conditions that have created who I am. When I do that, as I do that, process, I begin to challenge the bases of my being, the bases of my identity in the world, my community's identity, who I am, who we are, how I relate to others. And the thing that's beautiful, particularly about the Buddhist approach to this, is that it's all based in the understanding that that none of this ultimately is personal. Actually, that there's no separate individual here at all. That what this is the resonance of culture, or the flowering of conditions coming through this body and this life experience. But that body and life experience is just as conditioned as everything else. This is tremendously good news. One of the things that trips us up in consciousness raising is guilt. Is thinking that, like, oh, because I can find white supremacy supporting my privilege for a long time, I must be at fault for that, and then I feel guilty. Right? White guilt is a term now. It's a good term. It's a beautiful process to simultaneously uncover those patterns, make them literal, bring them out into the open, and to do the work of, this is a paradox, owning them, owning the way that they are constitutive of myself, and disidentifying with them, and saying, this is bigger than me, it's actually not me, but I carry it and I'm responsible for the aspect that I carry. That's the hard part. I'm responsible for my own privilege and actions, and yet I am the result of conditions that are larger than myself, that are just beyond myself, that are not myself. If we can do that, and that's a needle to thread, there's the possibility actually that this consciousness raising, this coming into awareness of a harmful cultural force like white supremacy, or like any of the deep cultural unwholesomenesses, is not separate from liberation at all. It's actually one of the things that most profoundly can open our sense of self, connect us to others, and begin to unbind greed, hatred, and delusion from our hearts in a very deep way, in a way that they have us bound even when we think they don't, even when we think we're free of them. So we're entering a period where white supremacy is more and more normalized and given power in this country. We're also in a period where it is being seen and named and called out like I've never seen before. So the Women's March is on Saturday. It's time, if you have a spirit of resistance in you, to engage in resistance. But not to forget the inward practice. So, all right, enough for now. Groovy. Take a moment. We'll take a moment in silence. Just let it land and settle. Just noticing the resonance of the topic in you, noticing your own body and presence. You might notice particularly how this topic, whether you're very, very familiar with it or less so, how it resonates in you. And of course, that'll be different for those of us who identify as white and those who do not, those of us of different cultural and racial backgrounds, have a very different relationship to this force. But we all know its effects in ourselves and around us. So, thanks for your kind attention. It's a pleasure. And we have some time just for some discussion, some hearing some of your voices, reflections on this, concerns. Please.
How does magnetism come into this?
Magnetism?
Yeah.
I don't know. What do you mean by magnetism?
That it we attract certain experiences to us, which might be that or something else. It's challenging or good.
Yeah, attracting experiences to us isn't language that I use, so I don't know exactly what to say. I know that what we focus on.
Mm-hmm.
Has a very strong effect in conditioning our state of mind as we go forward. So if I focus on a certain thing, that creates the conditions for me to keep focusing on that. So if I have thoughts of hatred or anger over and over, I will tend to be more hateful and angry. If I can shift my thoughts, my intentions toward kindness over and over, I practice that, then I will tend to have more thoughts of kindness. And then it appears that when I have more thoughts of kindness, I do more speaking kindly and acting kindly, and that seems to invite kindness, or it invites whatever comes, but that's what I can do. That's how I would understand inviting experience to us.
Well, I have an example. For example, you go to a retreat, you're rooming with somebody, and one person is snoring and then one cannot sleep. But you went there to, both people went there for a retreat.
Yeah.
What kind of magnetism is that?
I think it's chance, actually.
It's just, some people called it magnetism. Yeah, it was magnetized,
totally. Attracted. It's, for sure. That's not my field, so
okay.
I don't know.
I was just wondering if that was something to do with karma.
No. When I have a roommate that snores, I either put in earplugs, one time I actually just went out and slept in the hall. So, you work with it however you can.
Yeah.
Yeah. That's more, please.
I guess what came up for me was thinking about, you know, when you're unaware, it's almost like ignorance is bliss, and then you start to become aware, and things that you're becoming aware of are really painful.
Yeah.
And there's a lot of suffering and fear, and
yeah.
And I just wanted to ask you about, like, first of all, how to, you know, relate to that in yourself, but also how to ask other people.
Yeah.
To do something that's really, really uncomfortable. And
yeah.
More than uncomfortable, painful, and terrifying.
Absolutely, mm-hmm. Absolutely. How
so
to?
If I can do that for myself.
Yeah, absolutely, absolutely. First, a very traditional, in a sense, Buddhist answer and a framework for that. I think that the only way I can do something that's very, very difficult or painful, like you're saying, you know, expose something that hurts or is frightening so much, is if I feel safe enough or held in a larger understanding, right? So, like, if I get radicalized into the movement and I'm like, this is the righteous thing to do, and I have people around me who are like, this is the righteous thing to do, and we're going to get together and we're going to do it together, and it hurts, but it's the right thing to do, right? That's a force that will help me to tolerate the pain of doing it, right? So community and a belief system. In Buddhist practice, that structure is provided first by the community, so by Sangha, by being in a community of practitioners, and then even more so, or differently, for me, very powerfully, by refuge. And refuge is, in the Buddhist system, in a sense, a foundational commitment to being on the path. So if I believe that what I'm here to do is to awaken, to become like the Buddha, completely free from greed, hatred, and delusion. And then I hear my teacher say, you have to do this, you know, you have to excavate the painful and see it clearly. That is the way to freedom. If I believe that, if I believe in the Buddha, the Dharma, the Sangha, if I taken refuge, refuge can be strong enough to hold me in that, right? Because I can, rather than just being like, oh, that's really painful, I don't want to do that. I could be like, that's really painful and I don't want to do it, but I believe that it's for the good. Or like, I know in my heart that it's for the good. And that belief system is strong enough, if it is, to hold that. And in a sense, not just about, you know, sort of the like the socio-political like this, but in the course of practice, we must come upon that which is tremendously painful. Because we have to come to the foundations of the self, right? And so we need a foundation, whether it's refuge, community, belief system, to do that. So to invite other people in, what I would want to do before we can do that, and what in, you know, certainly in many activist circles this is gospel, you have to create a safe space and a really clear container. You know, so like, we're going to meet in this place for these weeks with these people, no drop-ins, confidentiality, we're going to share our stories, we're going to do no crosstalk, we're going to like, you make structures so that we can feel free to do that thing and feel safe enough to do it. Yeah? So that's, a lot of that is sort of basic skip, like process skills, essentially. But I think that the foundation of refuge, or whatever foundational belief system, and justice can be a refuge, you know, can also do it for people. Whatever makes you strong enough to face your demons. Yeah.
I would add that white supremacy, patriarchy, capitalism are foundational belief systems of our culture, which are delusions, and therefore need to be harm all of us, and need to be excavated.
Yeah.
And so partially we have unearned privilege from those systems, and white supremacy hurts white folks and patriarchy hurts men, and the systems themselves are false constructs. So as we unpack them more, it leads to everybody's liberation.
Yeah.
And we walk through different paths of pain to get there sometimes, but that's helpful to me, that having sort of knowing that makes the path seem a little more feasible.
Yeah, like knowing, seeing that they affect everyone and how systemic they are. The Buddha called his teachings going against the stream of the culture, and it's said that when he was about to sit down and become enlightened, he had eaten this one sort of magical meal that was given to him by a woman from the town in a ritual way, and he said, you know, if I'm on the right track for full liberation, may this bowl float upstream. And he threw it in the river, and it floated against the current. It's a myth that came up sort of. It's not in the earliest texts, but it arrived later on. And there is this sense, if you want to uproot greed, hatred, and delusion in your heart in a very deep way, that you're gonna start chipping away at the habits that our culture has given you. And, you know, you could start with anything. You could start with shopping, right? You could start with believing things that show up on Facebook. Like, you could start anywhere. You could start with, you know, the extra cookie that you don't really need. Like, wherever you start, you hit greed, hatred, and delusion, and you dig from there, you know. And it's okay to start at the surface, right? We have to, you know. But eventually we will come into conflict with these conditions in our culture. You will come into conflict with the deep ideologies that cause suffering because they are here. Right? And I think that's a good thing. It's a good thing. Other thoughts?
about, now, you've been telling us a story about history.
Yeah.
And about how these relations of power and relations of prejudice have come to be.
Right.
Right? And if I understood you correctly, you're trying to push against the tendency to ascribe, say, white supremacy to individuals who hold that ideology as something for which they're responsible in an essential way.
In an essential way?
Crucial.
Yes, yes.
Responsible in all kinds of other ways, but not essentially.
Right.
Now, what's tricky for me is that it seems like here we have to piece apart different kinds of contingency.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
If this makes sense. So they're all, you're telling a story about the history of the British Empire, right?
Yeah.
as one story about how white supremacy comes to take the form that it takes.
Yeah.
Right. And that's a series of historical conditions and, frankly, accidents.
Yeah.
For which there is no master plot.
Right.
And we end up where we are today. But then the language in which we treat white supremacy and the ways we have to respond to it, if we're to be responsible.
Yeah.
Like, these two things strike me as being athwart one another in a complicated way.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. How do you push against a series of historical accidents that has no conceivable beginning, right, or form? It's like you know, you're doing kung fu against a wind dragon, right? Which, you know, there's a whole realm we could go to with that, but it feels like that sometimes. Like, it's like this fog that's around and there's nothing to hit. You know, you strike any one, you know, racially biased person. Right, what do you get? You know, you get your way to like a noxious internet chat room, and like a very ambiguous spread of traumatized people. But that's not the head of the snake, right? And in a certain way, there is no head of the snake, even though we're about to inaugurate one. Right.
So and that's a terrific answer to my question, which is essentially how a Buddhist would view this problem of local moral responsibility, but moral responsibility that is in a sense detached from the causal chain.
Yeah, right? Yeah. One of the things it's a beautiful question. It's well phrased. From a strong historian, no doubt. No, really, go look him up. But it's in a way part of what we're talking about is the conditioned but non-linear relationship between the individual, the family, the community, the culture, and the world of historical karmic activity. I'm mixed race, I'm half Puerto Rican, I was adopted by white people, but my birth dad was raised by Pentecostalist Puerto Ricans in a Bronx kind of a very, very working class community. He ran away from New York when his best friend was shot in high school, and he ran away to Connecticut. Connecticut. Freedom. But it wasn't the Bronx. He got out.
White people.
White people, right? Very complex little story. And he met a nice white girl from Illinois, and voila. Here I am. So like, to ascribe to him specifically, or then to me specifically, of a particular lineage of anything, right, is impossible. So I want to come to like the what do you actually do? And there's a lot of ways I could answer that. One way I'll say it is to say that Buddhism has always been an evangelical religion, and that it relies on the spread of a belief system. It actually functions through community. It's not a people. It's not a tribe. The Buddha actually said once there were 500 enlightened monks, there was, in other words, enough to mass to sort of spread out. He said, go now out in all directions. Don't even go two together. Just head out there and preach the Dharma. And the foundations of what's being preached to lay people are generosity, kindness, keeping the precepts. So acting to protect life and to protect, relationships, etc. And then ultimately to ordain people to give their lives to practice. And so it depends, I think, on the spread of a counter-ideology, right? You have to actually convince people to want to act differently, right? And in a certain way, I think, and this is a side note, we'll end with a momentary bit of snark. This is partly where American secular Buddhism, I think, partly drops the ball,
yes.
Right? Because it actually has let go of both teaching the ethical practices as a cornerstone. It's also let go of conversion. It's let go of trying to convince people to do anything. And if you let go of trying to convince people to be different, what you end up doing is giving them a few nice skills with which they can continue to be just the way they are. This is complicated by the fact that most of us are so uncomfortable with how we are that we need to hear the teaching that it's okay to be how we are for at least a decade before we can get on to any kind of self-improvement. And there is improvement to be done. So we talked actually a week or two ago about self-judgment, so you can go and listen to that. All the talks I'm now recording, it's nice to do that. They're up on my website. It's our time to go. And a couple minutes past it. It's a pleasure to open this beautiful and complex can of historical worms with you. Please vote next time. All right. I know you did, because we did mostly here. So I don't know what to do about that. I don't know what to do about them, to go back to where we started. Thank you for being here. It's absolutely a pleasure. This gathering is offered completely in the practice, the against the stream practice of gift economy. Your generosity supports everyone to come here, supports myself, my baby, who's beyond adorable, and the studio. Your donations are split in half between the studio and myself, and they go there in that basket on the shelf. See you next week. Thank you so much. Take good care.